RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for our health hacks this Monday morning with Dr. Glenn Davies. Glenn from reversalnz.co.nz. Glenn, great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me as always, Paul.
I remember last week at the end of the program, you mentioned what you wanted to talk about next, health hacks. Well, we are here now, and I've been looking forward to this chat. So what's it about this week, Glenn?
Well, I'm really interested in having a discussion with you, Paul, about the social consequences of the COVID-19 response, particularly looking at it from a medical perspective. But I'm wondering if we could turn it around a little bit. I'm quite interested in interviewing you. You've had so many conversations with so many people over this period of time since the beginning of the COVID response. And I think it's now time within medicine, certainly, but within society, that we have some more open conversations about some of the detail. I'm just hoping if you and I have this conversation, we will encourage others to have it without the emotion, without the anger, but having debate. And I think one of the things that we've lost through this time is science does depend on debate. Now, and sometimes that debate can get a little bit heated, but in science, you always have to back your argument up with something substantial, with a clinical paper or with evidence. You know, and I think that's what needs to happen within the medical community.
Okay, we have an inquiry, a Royal Commission of Inquiry in progress, but that looks like it's going to be heavily modified with vastly expanded terms of reference. And of course, we're involved in that process. And also the commissioners are in question. So that's in play at the moment. All right, how do you want to start talking about this? Because we're kind of staying in the medical zone on this, perhaps not so much the, as you said, the emotional response or the other things that are bundled in with this. So where do you want to start?
Well, my overwhelming thought is that as a consequence of the COVID-19 response, there's been a loss of trust. And I think the challenge within our society, certainly within the medical realm, is to rebuild that trust. And I wondered if we could review some of these areas where trust has been lost. And then maybe at the end, Paul, you might have some ideas on how we could potentially rebuild trust within society, but particularly within medicine.
That may be above my pay grade. Let's see. But no, that sounds reasonable. If I was to say, for me, a good kickoff point in talking about trust, it would be when I receive the call from my medical provider, you know, historical medical provider. I was in another city at that point, but they didn't know that. And I asked some very simple questions. And at that time, I had kind of an open mind. I asked, first of all, has this been tested properly? Can you tell me? And I was told that MedSafe had approved it. Now, I knew through news that that wasn't actually technically correct, but I didn't make a deal of it. And I said, well, are there any problems with it? You know, can I confidently take this product? And she said, yes, of course you can. I said, well, I don't think I'm getting to a level of what I would call informed consent. Can you give me something that I can get informed consent or to that level on? And when I got to that, it became too difficult for the person on the phone. And I understand that. And it was, well, if you just come in, you can get it. See you later. Have a good day sort of thing. So that was the first interface that I had where I questioned trust. Because if you can't take me to informed consent and you're telling me something's approved when it's not, then I'm not going to go with you at this point. And that's where it kicked off for me there.
Yeah, and informed consent is one of the basic tenets of that relationship between an individual and the healthcare system. And, you know, the Cartwright inquiry really brought that to the fore, didn't it? And I think New Zealand has been so good at informed consent as a consequence of the Cartwright inquiry. But I think we've had some breakdown in that process with response or in response to the COVID-19 vaccines. Yeah.
What I did notice amongst, you know, peer group and family and colleagues at the time is that the lack of informed consent, being able to get to that bar, let's say, didn't seem to worry too many of them, which again had my interest, because I'm wondering why you where's your survival reflex? You know, it just didn't seem to be there for some anyway.
Now, Paul, I think you've nailed a really important point there. I think prior to this issue, there was a lot of trust and faith in medical process and the medical profession. And through this process of the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen an erosion of that confidence, trust and faith. And that's sort of what needs to return, if it can. But part of restoring it is, I guess, understanding why it's been lost. So you make a fantastic point. I think it was there, and many people did just trust, particularly I think the older people did. But now I think there's a lot more people in society with less trust than they had before.
The next thing that rung alarm bells for me was the denial of legacy medicines that overseas talk, research, and as far as I understood, safe medicines with a fantastic history, over billions of doses or applications over multiple decades, were completely suppressed. And I couldn't work out why that would be happening. Well, I had my suspicions, but I don't understand why you would do that. I just don't. And I said, well, I think I understand now, but that seemed to me to be a dereliction of duty almost.
Yeah. So one of the medicines that falls into the category you're talking about is ivermectin, isn't it? And this is an issue that I'm going to have to delve into a lot more detail. And this is a really good example of where that scientific debate based on clinical studies needs to happen. You know, we need to sit down and look at all of that evidence and then decide, is it robust or is it not? The problem is it takes a lot of time to do that. And I think before I went through this experience, I would have just trusted somebody else's summary of those documents. Now the obligation is to go and look at them myself and come to my own conclusions. In the discussions I've been having recently with various people in this area, there's different opinion about the effectiveness of, for example, ivermectin in COVID. Now the responsibility is on me to sit down and look at that evidence and form my own opinion. So, you know, from my point of view, I would have previously trusted someone else's opinion on it, and now I feel the obligation to do it myself, which takes a whole lot of time.
No, I bet. Yeah, I can understand that. But still, if you've got, even if the medicine doesn't work, let's say, if it has a safety profile that's sort of epic in terms of 60 years and billions of doses, what's there to lose? There's that, right?
There is that, but it does still have to work as well. You know, so there's two aspects, efficacy and safety. It has to have both to pass muster.
Well, I've known many people, I've never taken the medicine. I don't think I've even, well, I tested positive for it when I went in for my heart problem, which surprised me. Never had any symptoms. It worked out okay because I got a room to myself in an otherwise crowded ward for about 4 or 5 days. And that was nice, though people coming in looking like they're just fresh out of, you know, Spielberg's E.T. was a bit weird, but that was that. Never had it. But people who've been treated with it, whether it's a placebo effect or whatever, have sworn by it to me, and that's probably at least 10. So I do think there is something in that, but I know it doesn't take it to the, you know, the max in terms of the level of confirmation or whatever you call it. But it does seem that it had some effect. So again, why would you not have everything in the toolbox available is still a curious question I have. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things where I I think we've lost trust is in the pharmaceutical companies themselves. And I'm aware of between 2009 and 2014, there was $13 billion in fines against the pharmaceutical companies for, you know, like legally proven fault. And that was something I didn't know before the COVID response, and it's something that I do know now. You know, so I guess it's having this higher level of awareness of or suspicion that wasn't there before. And it's, yeah, a loss of trust in the pharmaceutical companies. I didn't have that before. I do now.
Yeah, it's like that. That's an eye-watering sum, but it's probably only a small, you know, cents on the dollars for the pharmaceutical industry. It's a trillion-dollar industry, I believe. So, I mean, it's a big amount, but it, in the scheme of the $1 trillion, it's small change. They obviously see those fines or being vulnerable to being fined as just the cost of business. Because if you're making a trillion in an industry and you're only paying out $13 billion in fines to make that trillion, that's probably quite a good business deal there.
It's perhaps like a tax.
Yeah. It's just the cost of doing things. Moving on, and I think this is in the medical space because, well, two things. First of all, there seemed to be a groupthink emerge in the medical establishment of New Zealand, and that was policed very heavily. And I know of a lot of those stories, and they're not very nice. You know, even down to the way people were treated was nasty, actually. And lives haven't been ruined, but they've been severely affected. So I don't understand why, you know, it would be sort of SS-like in that regard. I'm sure doctors and nurses are actually nice people. They don't need to be treated like that. But the other thing is we started to see bureaucrats and politicians who were not medical people, had no idea of it, and had political reasons for doing things, kind of coming into the space and making, as it has turned out, what are basically medical decisions that there's no way they were ever qualified to make. So I think that's in the trust thing as well.
Yeah, and I have some questions about the medical council's response. They certainly do have a requirement for doctors to be scientific, for doctors to base opinion on evidence. But did they go too far in their policing of these conversations? You know, and did that strict policing of these conversations mean that doctors felt uncomfortable about discussing some of these issues, which normally they wouldn't be? You know, normally you would be able to discuss with your colleagues some of these quite difficult and heated topics. You know, screening, for example, you would feel comfortable sharing your opinion on that. It felt like we weren't able to share opinions on the COVID response and debate it, you know, and in that process of debating it, you hear other people's opinions and sometimes you go, oh, I'm a bit off on that, or I need to research this more. You know, that is the part of the scientific process. It seemed to me to be a problem that we felt unable to have those conversations.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that. I'd really like to understand that. And I think a lot of people think about that like I do, you know. Why take the attitude? As an example, one of the people I interviewed relating to being engaged in a process that came from that, that was a post on a private Facebook group, not a public group, a private of, you know, a community of, I think, nurses. And I've seen what was written. It's staunch, but it's reasonable if you're considering all things. Someone complained, and, you know, that person is fined, who's a mother, just a mother of three, or maybe even five. I think she had triplets, you know, facing down a $16,000 fine and sort of being harangued and shamed for spreading vaccine hesitancy, the sort of the general term, in a private Facebook group. Now, that to me seems to be completely unreasonable, driven by I don't know what. And that's the sort of thing we're talking about.
Yeah, there's a pressure here between the right free speech, the right to express your opinion, the opposite pressure is a public health strategy, and that's where the pressure sat. Did we get the balance point right? I think is the discussion, and that's what I hope might be one of the conversations that occur in the Royal Inquiry. You know, was it over-policed? Did we go too far?
Okay, I've got a list here. I'm working through it. I thought that there was something in what people were saying about the general, and we've talked about this, the general health of people, just the default health status of people. And it seemed that we started to find out what were the comorbidity factors. And, I mean, I was at the airport on Sunday at Auckland, and McDonald's was over just over the way. And I looked over there because I'm a lot more conscious about how healthy people look, Glenn, since I've got to know you. And, you know, all of them were overweight, every single one at the counter. And I understand why that is. But, you know, circling back to the COVID time, there was no promotion of easy health strategies. They involve a little discipline. I know that. You know, the vitamin D as well, nutrition, maybe losing some weight. We had quite a few years to do that if we really wanted to. And here were, you know, media personalities in car parks on TV doing jabathons, giving away KFC vouchers. Now, I don't understand how that works. It seems like, you know, it's the two are opposite. And again, you know, what would you have to say about that?
I think, Paul, that was one of the greatest missed opportunities through this whole response. We knew very, very early on that it was people with metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, overconsumption of ultra-processed food, the stuff we've talked about a lot. We knew very, very early on that they were the people at risk of bad outcomes if they got COVID. It was a perfect opportunity to do something about it, and we missed that opportunity. I think it's a reflection of something bigger. It's this pharmaceutical model versus the terrain model, germ theory versus host theory. You know, like, it was a wonderful opportunity to encourage people to think about their health, to make better opportunities about how they ate, how much exercise they did, etc., getting more sunlight. And we missed that opportunity from a public health marketing point of view. It was a wonderful opportunity, and it was completely missed. I think that's one of the, there's many regrets, but that was one of my greatest regrets through this whole time. We missed a perfect opportunity. We had people tuning in every day to listen to public health experts talking on public health. You know, we missed the opportunity to talk about the big ticket item, which was keep the host healthy. And if the host is healthy, you will inevitably have better outcomes if you do get COVID-19.
And similarly, the media seem to take on medical expertise of their own all of a sudden. I noticed that, and I would call it the promotion of that campaign was joined by the media, and we know sort of why that is. There was a lot of money to be made, hay to be made during that time with advertising, and I know how much some of the media entities made from that advertising, and it was full retail, as best couple of years they ever had from a single client. Yet they had hosts and journalists doing pieces on supporting the campaign, but there was no even reporting showing the other side. Both sides weren't covered. And of course, that messaging is very powerful to people. A lot of people believe what they hear. So the media encroaching, again, like politicians did, into the medical space, as if they knew what they were talking about. They didn't have a clue. They didn't know. I know some of these people, they're not that bright. They wouldn't know that. But yet, that was pushed very hard. And I think that's dangerous when you do that. That's dangerous because when people's lives are at stake, if that's wrong, you can have a disaster on your hands. And who's holding? Who's responsible for that? So that's another, again, it's trust. Most of this is trust that I think was something that, it kind of made me bail out of the mainstream media because I was part of it at that point, you know. So that's another thing. But media encroaching into your space as if they thought they knew what they were talking about.
It's an interesting topic. I don't know what listeners would imagine I knew about immunology and virology and modeling and public health responses and even vaccines before this. But I had to do a whole lot of very, very quick learning to get up to speed. And I'm sure that many of us have, and I imagine that most of the listeners, you know, have almost become experts in a lot of these topics. But you're so right. The media, certainly at the beginning, didn't have that expertise. And your comments, I think, are very valid. But we all became very, very educated in these complex medical topics. It's a really good example to me that people have a huge ability to learn complex information if they spend the time and do it. And so many people have, haven't they? They've become very well educated in complex topics. Virology is not a simple topic, and nor is immunology.
Yet people were told that it was wrong to do their own research. Well, when has it ever been wrong to do your own research on something?
Well, I don't know about you, Paul, but would you take your car to the mechanic and say, oh, it stopped? Or would you spend a bit of time Googling it and trying to work it out before you went to the mechanic? You know, like, I think that's very, very old school to think that you wouldn't Google a problem and look into it before you consulted a consultant about it. So yeah, strange. And this one source of truth idea, defining what is science and what is not science, to me is the epitome of anti-science. You know, science requires hypothesis and then debate and then study, you know, but something is not anti-science because it asks a question about the established science. That is scientific process. That was disturbing.
I think the word gaslighting sort of applies here, because you're being told one thing from a source of truth that was obviously at complete odds with the other possibilities. And that was, do I say, done in the knowledge that there was other thinking? It probably was, but that was never aired. So, I mean, you don't do that to people. That's not a nice thing to do. It's another thing. Right.
And also, I think that's one of the fundamental reasons for the loss of trust, because if you have trust, you will have an open discussion, talk about the issues, debate them, and then come to a conclusion. That's how trust in a relationship occurs. Trust does not occur by someone saying, I'm right, you are wrong, believe this. You know, that does not create trust. It creates suspicion and births conspiracy theories. You know, and the word conspiracy theory, I know that's a terrible term, but these questions, when something doesn't make sense or seems wrong and you try and find an explanation, it births a whole lot of theories, some of them which end up being true and some which end up not being true.
All right, we've got the clock ticking. I see on, you know, the topics within this that we could talk about, there's the change in society, division, more extreme left-right divide. I think all that has happened. But I think the really tragic thing, I remember the big event in my time was the Springbok Tour in 1981. That divided the nation, but it was not like this. It was rugby, okay? And you're right to go in a rugby racing beer country, as it was. It's probably still a rugby racing something or rugby beer something country. You know, that it was your right to go and watch your rugby matches. And that's fair enough. But then there was another issue of apartheid and all that. Don't need to go through all the details of that. That caused a division, but that was very soon over. Once the dust had settled and people had taken a deep breath, it was pretty well back to business as usual. It was only just a disruption over a period of time that tour was approaching and here. In this one, those divisions are still there and maybe even more extreme. And I think to force that, to do that to a society like ours was, well, I don't want to drop F-bombs and S-bombs, but that it makes me mad as hell, because I've experienced that. And I didn't want that. I didn't ask for that. No one asked for that. Yet that's what it did. And unless you've got your head up somewhere, you know that's going to happen, yet you still push it. So I just make that comment as well.
Yeah. And I'm with you there.
Yep.
I'd never seen that degree of separation, that left-right divide in New Zealand before. It's reminiscent of American politics, not New Zealand society as I knew it.
And how can a medical choice be a political one?
Mm-hmm.
It's got nothing to do with it. Unless I'm missing something. All right. So this is probably, well, no, one more comment. Then we have the excess, all-cause excess mortality. Then we have our own personal experiences. I could go down a whole list of people I know who are either not here or still here with problems. Never seen those numbers before, you know, involving everything from turbo brain cancers to just waking up or not waking up. And obviously through RCR and NZD, SOS, we're aware of many individuals who have big problems, yet we're not allowed to talk about it. There doesn't seem to be any urgency to find out what's going on here. If it was four 747s crashing every quarter of the year with 500 people on board, you know, they'd be grounding the entire global fleet. So I think this is now where if there's going to be an inflection point, this is the area where it's going to be. To look at data, and this is the inquiry process in terms of reference and all of that, to work out best we can what is going on. And if it shows something that's ugly, we have to deal with it.
Yeah, and we are part of the world's biggest cohort study. 5.5 billion have had the intervention and 2.5 billion have not had the intervention. This is probably the biggest event in medicine of all time. It is a wonderful opportunity for study and research, yet there seems to be a reluctance to look at it. Now, and to me, that is unscientific. That is anti-science. You know, we need to be looking at this aggressively, openly, and honestly. And it feels like that isn't happening yet.
Yeah. And in terms of trust, and this is a question to you now as a GP, I've heard people who are pretty solid citizens for a long time, bought the whole system, all of that, say now, I'll never go to a GP again. I'll just go to a hospital if I've got an emergency, because I don't trust any of them. I don't believe, well, that they know what they're talking about or what they're saying as evidenced by what has happened. And I think that's fair enough to have those thoughts. It's probably could be cutting your nose off to spite your face in some circumstances, but that is the level of feeling. How does that make you feel as a GP?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that particular question a lot. I think the level of trust in the family doctor has reduced. And what I think has happened is, always in the past, it was you and your GP versus the world. It was you and your GP that fought with ACC to get entitlements. It was you and your GP that fought with Work and Income to get a disability allowance. It was you and your GP that fought with the outpatient clinic to move you up the waiting list because it was urgent. That was the team. And it felt like that feeling of team has been broken. And it feels to me that the GPs sided with the pharmaceutical industry or the pharmaceutical model. And in many cases, they weren't there on the side of their client or their patient. And whether that was perceived or real, I can't comment on that, but I think that's the perception. And that loss of trust in your family doctor, who has been your doctor for 35 years, has delivered your children, looked after them, they've grown up and had children of their own. He or she was on your side, in your team, and it feels like that has broken down to some extent, and I really hope that that can come back. But I think part of rebuilding that trust is looking scientifically, honestly and accurately at what has happened, and where there have been wins, celebrate the wins, but where there have been losses or problems, look at them and correct them. You know, and that's all that I'm asking of this Royal Commission of Inquiry, is to honestly look at it, and from it we learn. I think there's a lot to learn. You know, for me, the biggest error was, I think, mandating COVID vaccines was the step too far.
Yeah.
I think we would have coped as a society with the first lot of lockdowns. We certainly would have been comfortable with the vaccine being available for people who wanted it. I think we would have even coped with some gentle persuasion, you know, but forcing, like the mandating of the COVID vaccines, for me was a step too far. And that's what I think needs to really be looked at. And if we are in a situation like this again, I think we have to value informed consent and the right of people to choose. That to me is my learning from it. You know, mandating vaccines was one step too far.
Can I just add something to that? Because I think there's a layer underneath that is there too, that needs to be acknowledged. And that is, okay, so you don't mandate a vaccine, but if you're promoting a vaccine that has had no testing, no track record, is a novel GMO, basically, as we understand it now, even if you make it available and don't mandate it and promote it, you are still potentially doing a hell of a lot of damage, and you are abusing rights in that way as well.
Yeah. Like, if you look at it from a different perspective, this might be a perspective that not many of the listeners share, but if there was a global threat and there was a potential solution and we can fast track that to protect people, you know, that is a valid scientific aim. You know, but the science requires us to look carefully right through that process. And as soon as those warning signals came up, we needed to be looking at them very, very carefully. I hope the Royal Commission looks at that. Were the warning signals looked at, or were they ignored? I think that's one of the big questions. And people who raised these concerns, were they heard and given voice, or was that suppressed? I think that really needs to be looked at.
And the last point I'd make, don't worry, it's the last, and you'll have a view on this, I'm sure. I have seen the breakdowns of who administered what shots where and how much they were paid. Some were paid in the millions, tens of millions to do that. And also there was the fear of doctors and medical staff of having jobs in jeopardy, which is a very powerful thing. I mean, no one wants to not be able to put food on the table for the family. There seemed to be a commercial element incentive to this as well. Is there any place for that in a situation like we had? Because it creates incentives, perverse incentives, to warp what would be, you know, a normal response. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're asking a really valid question, and I also hope that that's something that the Royal Commission looks at. You know, it's as simple as advertising direct medicines directly to patients, and I think there's only two countries in the world that allow that. You know, so this whole issue of financial incentives, commercial involvement in medical process, it's a big topic, and I really hope the Royal Commission extends to look at these bigger issues, not did we get the right number of PCR tests at the right time, should we have got them a week earlier. I hope that the Royal Commission looks at the very, very big global issues, the influence of the pharmaceutical companies over medical journals, over university curriculums, as big as that, and then comes down to this detail, but doesn't just deal with the detail. And how are people incentivized is part of that big question that you just asked.
I mean, no one should be doing stuff for nothing. You know, it's work, labor involved. But when it's when it's being when good information is being hidden to protect that opportunity, that's and no one knows about it at the time. That's, I think, a pretty
And that's actually scientific. I'm thinking back to a 2004 study that looked at 102 randomized trials, and of that, 2/3 of them incompletely reported the harms. You know, so yeah, there's big problems that I guess the COVID-19 response was a manifestation of some bigger, more global issues. And I don't think the Royal Commission can look at these specific issues without looking at these bigger, more pervasive issues, because it will fail if it narrows its view to just those details.
And people are expecting an honest approach, and if it's not there, we're not back at square one, but we're kind of going back towards square one, because there's no closure, to use that term. This has been very cathartic for me, Glenn.
Well, Paul, it's something that I've really wanted to talk about, but I've been reluctant to do that. But I feel that enough time has passed where we can, in a mature, in a scientific, in a respectful way, start to have these debates. And you're not the first person that said to me, having this conversation has been cathartic, because there is a lot of emotion behind it. I think it's important that we learn how to discuss these things, certainly within medicine, without the emotion, you know, based on the science. I hope in our conversation I have been scientific in everything that we've discussed. But, you know, for me personally also, there's a lot of emotion around these issues, and I do want the opportunity to discuss them, but I really think science depends on us having these conversations. And to restore that massive divide that has happened in our society, I think we have to start having these conversations and be able to talk to people with opposite opinions and come to some sort of place in the middle where we agree to disagree, or we do agree. You know, that has to happen, but it particularly has to happen in medicine. You know, medicine has to be reborn from this experience. We have to think about what's important, you know, informed consent, lack of coercion, being scientific, basing our opinions on facts, not the last thing we saw on YouTube. You know, all that has to happen for the trust to be rebuilt in medicine.
All right. I'm sure a lot of people will want to comment on this, so we're gonna get it. So maybe at the next Health Hacks, we can maybe go through some of that, the greatest hits of it, let's say, because there'll be lots. You're up for that, aren't you?
I think if you and I have got a spare 20 hours, we'll be able to sit down and read the responses. And I'm imagining that a lot of the response will be Dr. Davies just skimmed the surface and didn't go far enough. But that was deliberate, in that I think we need to begin the conversation.
I understand. I think people understand. Glenn, fascinating. Another great Health Hacks.
Next might be discussing the responses.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.